which are inaccessible to prisoners themselves and their lawyers.
Despite international rejection of administrative detentions, Tel Aviv is pushing with the illegal practice. It continues to trigger more hunger strikes by the Palestinian inmates who say their move is a legitimate means to resist the Israeli policy. Muna Qandil, Occupied Ramallah.
Scores of Shia Muslims were injured and many more were arrested after government forces resorted to batons to file a mourning procession in the capital city of Indian-administered Kashmir. The authorities had imposed strict restrictions and blocked several entry and exit points in Srinagar to prevent the traditional event held on the 8th Muharram, the first month of the Islamic calendar. Defying restrictions, hundreds of people, some holding flags, poured onto the streets at several places in the city center. However, police attacked them and fired several rounds of tear gas shells to disperse the mourners.
All our Indian people enjoy religious freedom, but when it comes to Kashmir, they adopt double standards. Peaceful mourners here are thrashed and arrested for raising Labaik Ya Hussain slogans.
The police also beat journalists covering the event. For the last three decades, the authorities have banned the traditional 8th Muharram and Ashura processions in the main city, citing security reasons. Despite repeated pleas by religious bodies over the years, the ban has not been lifted till date. This year, the authorities had initially hinted at lifting the ban, but later denied permission to take out the procession.
The government is hurting the religious sentiments of people here. We condemn it in the strongest term. Kashmiri's people have made it very clear that they will not accept a ban on procession. Even if they are beaten and arrested, they will raise the flag of Imam Hussain.
The authorities say that the procession stoke anti-India sentiments and pose, quote, serious security threats. But the people here argue that if the authorities can allow the annual Hindu pilgrimage that attracts over 500,000 people, why not Muslim processions? Muharram processions in Kashmir date back to 1527 AD.
It's been 32 years and the status quo is intact. Every year, mourners defy restrictions and get thrashed in return. Religious bodies have strongly condemned the use of force against the peaceful mourners and termed the ban as a blatant breach of religious freedom and demanded its immediate withdrawal. Saidri Safi, Indian-administered Kashmir.
Packing their bags and leaving behind a country laying in ruins. British troops and nationals following their American counterparts out of Afghanistan. Just as it was at the time of the war in 2001, criticism is rife of the so-called cross-Atlantic alliance's handling of the deepening crisis and indeed of the outcome of the 20-year occupation.
This is the biggest betrayal. I know the West have betrayed us in the 90s when we fought against the Soviet Union. You know, when Britain and America brought every terrorist to Afghanistan, including Bin Laden and others, they brought them to Afghanistan and they left them there. When the Russians were defeated, they left and abandoned Afghanistan. And when 9/11 happened, you know, suddenly they realized, you know, there are terrorists in the world. There is a regime called Taliban.
Touted as the war on terror, the military conflict in Afghanistan has cost the UK more than 450 troops and at least £37 billion in taxpayer money, roughly £2,000 per household. As their retreat from Afghanistan descended into a shambles, UK Prime Minister Boris Johnson has called on Parliament to reconvene next week to discuss the situation on the ground. A little too late.
If I were the British, you know, military personnel, I would be suing the British government for sending my kids to Afghanistan. Those who were killed, you know, they should claim compensation from the British government for the betrayal and you know, the chaos and the mayhem and the anarchy they have, brought back to Afghanistan after 20 years of illegal occupation.
It is now the morning after, and Britain and other colonial powers have the task of finding what they call like-minded powers not to recognize the Taliban's rule.
In a matter of weeks, the Afghans, and indeed the rest of the world, woke up to a new reality. The Taliban back in power 20 years after they were toppled by the U.S.-led coalition, handing the U.S., the U.K., and their other NATO allies a humiliating defeat with long-term consequences. Saeed Pariza, London.
Washington's so-called war on terror has failed in Afghanistan as the Taliban are now back after 20 years of fighting against the US-led forces. The militants entered Kabul with facing almost no resistance. Afghan ousted President Ashraf Ghani fled the country, saying he left Afghanistan because he wanted to avoid bloodshed.
I congratulate this great victory on the entire Muslim nation of Afghanistan, particularly the honorable residents of Kabul and our Mujahideen. We didn't expect such a fast victory, but we gained it by the help of God. I also assure all our countrymen of their safety. Don't be scared and resume your normal life.
As facts on the ground show, the Taliban are trying to gain popularity among all as a move to help them strengthen their rule over the country. They say their agenda is to provide security for all Afghans, including women and minorities, who have suffered decades of invasion, war, injustice, and insecurity. The fall of capital Kabul has created a big question in the minds of rural Afghans. That is, how can the Taliban bring unity, improvement, and lasting peace to gain public support in the country?
We are tired of war and ask the Taliban to prove how they are planning to gain people's trust and support the rule over the country.
The fall of Kabul has prompted many Afghans to leave their country for fear of their life. Reports say at least 5 people were killed in the airport as Afghans scrambled to flee. According to eyewitnesses, American troops repeatedly shot in the air to dispel the crowds. Video released on social media showed dozens of people running alongside a U.S. plane as it taxied along the runway before takeoff. Afghanistan's Civil Aviation Authority says that the airspace had been released to the military and advised transit flights to reroute, saying there would be no air traffic control. Most countries have begun to evacuate their citizens along with diplomatic staff, with the U.S. planning to deploy more troops in Afghanistan to hasten its evacuation. Hundreds of Afghans, including those in possession of visas, have rushed into Kabul International Airport to get a flight and flee the country. This proves that the hope and optimism of Afghans on the fate of their country have smashed due to what most here believe is the outcome of heavy U.S. military presence in the country over the past 2 decades. Sayed Amin Alemi, Kabul.
On Sunday, August 15, 2021, India celebrated its 75th Independence Day. In Indian-administered Kashmir, the main event to mark the day was held in the region's capital city, Srinagar. The region's Lieutenant Governor Manoj Sinha unfurled the national flag and took salute from the parade. The event was largely attended by government functionaries. The region's officials had temporarily relaxed COVID restrictions for Independence Day.
Revocation of Article 370 marked the beginning of a new era for Jammu and Kashmir. The neighboring country, which does not care for its own people, has been making malicious attempts to instigate our youth. They will be given a befitting reply.
While the mood inside the stadium was ecstatic, outside the people observed spontaneous shutdown to protest what they call New Delhi's failure to address the wishes and aspirations of the people. They say that New Delhi's stripping of Kashmir's special status in 2019 has further alienated the people of Kashmir.
Independence Day is important for every nation, and those who are celebrating independence on 15th August or 14th August across the border, they must realize that Kashmiris too have aspiration, and this aspiration must be respected.
The authorities had heightened security, deployed sharpshooters, and pressed drones into service to keep watch over the region's capital city and prevent any attack by the armed pro-independence groups. They also issued directions to heads of educational institutes to hoist the Indian flag at their respective schools. The order has drawn strong criticism from different quarters. Meanwhile, unlike the past, internet and mobile services have remained unaffected on the Independence Day in Kashmir. Kashmir is a bone of contention between India and Pakistan. Both the nations claim the region in full, but rule it in parts.
As India celebrates its 75th Independence Day, life here in Kashmir has again come to a grinding halt. Observers believe unless New Delhi addresses the basic issue of Kashmir and reduces the trust deficit, it cannot win the hearts and minds of the people here. Saidali Safir, Indian-administered Kashmir.
Palestinians took part in a rally in the Gaza Strip marking the 20th anniversary of the killing of Abu Ali Mustafa, the leader of the Popular Front for the Liberation of Palestine. Abu Ali Mustafa was assassinated in an Israeli attack in Ramallah in 2001. Palestinians said they participated in this rally to renew their support for the Palestinian resistance, expressing they will continue the road of resistance in defending their rights.
Today, the Popular Front for the Liberation of Palestine is marking the 20th anniversary of the assassination of our leader, Abu Ali Mustafa. By holding this huge rally titled With Knowledge and Resistance, we will build the next generation of freedom and victory. We view the resistance as the only way out of the current crisis. We have many allies from Iran to Syria, Lebanon and Al-Quds, which stand against the Israeli regime.
This rally comes in conjunction with the Resistance Front warning it won't tolerate any more Israel's reluctance to meet Palestinians' demands, especially those related to ending the suffocating siege imposed on the Gaza Strip.
Today, all Palestinian resistance factions are marking Abu Ali Mustafa's assassination, vowing to follow in the footsteps of their leaders. Today, Palestinians are involved in a continuous struggle against Israel, especially in Al-Quds, defending their lands. We call for a unified stance in fight against the occupation.
Organizers said this event marks the ongoing resistance until the main goals of all Palestinians are achieved. Resistance factions renewed their pledge to defend the Palestinian people and sent a new warning to the Israeli regime that the coming generations are the generations of liberation.
We believe that generations after generations will keep resisting against Israeli occupation. The Israeli regime should be held accountable for its crimes, and the international community should break its silence towards them.
Palestinians here stress on not only support their resistance and follow the steps of the leaders, but also defend their rights with all means until liberating all Palestine. Ruba Shabet, Gaza.
What started as a quiet day for the residents of Keyham in Plymouth, southwest England, ended with a tragedy. A mass shooting by a white male who took six lives, including his own. The mood here, one of absolute shock and horror.
Sad as well, obviously, all the people that have lost their lives, the people that are injured, the people that are affected by it. It's just sickening.
It's completely wrong to kill innocent people and your own family. It's not fair. It's not acceptable. The guy needed help, evidently. He probably wasn't given the help he needed.
I mean, it is very scary. Like, you just don't want to go out, do you? You want to stay inside and be safe.
Jake Davidson, a 23-year-old apprentice crane operator, was a licensed gun owner who launched a lone wolf attack using a pump-action shotgun, according to witnesses.
It all started with the gunman shooting a woman in one of the houses up that hill behind me and ended with him taking his own life. Six lives lost in nearly 6 minutes.
Police said his motive was still unknown.
There is no motive as we know at present. Again, that will be subject to inquiry, but we are at the moment not considering terrorism or a relationship with any far-right group or any such other group.
But Davidson's social media accounts offer a window into his state of mind. A case in point, a video post on YouTube where he considers himself as the Terminator.
The whole premise of the Terminator movies is that, you know, everything's rigged against you. There's no hope for humanity. You know, we're on the brink of extinction.
He was also believed to have been a member of Incel, a notorious online community of celibate men with misogynistic views. Police have called the incident not terror-related, raising questions about whether the police would give the same designation if the gunman were someone from a minority group. The UK has stringent gun ownership laws. The last time such an incident happened was in 2010,
perpetrated by a taxi driver who killed 18 people and injured several more. It's almost clear Davison was radicalized online, which begs the question whether the authorities could have done more to prevent the horrifying killing spree. Saeed Puriza, Plymouth.
Another illegal move on Yemen soil has taken place by the United Kingdom, as it has sent 40 soldiers of its special forces and an electronic warfare unit to Al Marib province in eastern Yemen, on the pretext of finding the perpetrators of an attack on an Israeli-managed oil tanker off the coast of Oman last month.
Such UK moves in Yemen are not new, whether in Al Mahra or elsewhere. Britain has an agent in the region, the UAE. All of Britain's efforts in Yemen, through its Emirati proxy, are focused on advancing the interests of the Israeli regime. What's happening today is considered a betrayal to the country by former President Abdrabbu Mansour Hadi. He has kept mum in the face of the British-Israeli moves in violation of Yemen's sovereignty.
An observer believes Saudi Arabia is the party behind the recent attack on the ship and says the deployment of the UK forces is aimed at justifying the presence of Saudi Arabia in Al Marib, as the regime has failed to take control of the province that has the longest coastal strip on the Arabian Sea.
The deployment of British soldiers to Al Marib came in the wake of the attack carried out by Saudi Arabia against the Mercer Street oil tanker. Ansarullah was accused of being behind the attack, but this accusation was later denied. The presence of the British forces was planned beforehand. Since Saudi Arabia has failed to control the province of Al Marib, and many people there are against the presence of Saudi forces, and they cannot remain there for a long time, as there are capable military forces in the country.
The people of Al Marib have repeatedly voiced protest against the presence of Saudis on their land. However, the presence of foreign forces in Yemen is not limited to the UAE, Saudi Arabia, or the UK. A US plane carrying 300 American soldiers and officers, along with 12 Black Hawk helicopters, arrived in Aden in southern Yemen last month.
Yemenis say the recent UK move proves that colonial ambitions by foreign powers are rising rapidly amid fragile situation in the southern and eastern areas of Yemen. They have also made it clear that they will continue fighting until all of Yemen's land is liberated and foreign forces are pushed out of the country. Abdul Latif Al Washali, Sana'a.
This is IRIB English Radio. Please log on to our website, www.parstoday.com/EM. the supplication on Fridays. In the name of Allah, the All-Merciful, the All-Compassionate. Praise belongs to Allah, the first before the bringing forth and the giving of life, and the last after the annihilation of all things. The All-Knowing who forgets not him who remembers him, and decreases not him who thanks him, and disappoints not him who supplicates him, and cuts not off the hope of him who hopes in him. O Allah, I call thee to witness, and thou art sufficient witness, and I call to witness all thy angels, and the inhabitants of thy heavens, and the bearers of thy throne, and thy prophets, and thy messengers, whom thou hast sent out, and the various kinds of creatures thou hast brought forth, that I bear witness that thou art Allah. There is no God but thou, thou alone, who hast no associate nor any equal, and thy word has no failing nor any change. And that Muhammad, Allah bless him and his household, is thy servant and thy messenger. He delivered to the servants that with which thou charged him, and he struggled for Allah as is his due. And he gave the good news of the truth of reward, and he warned of the veracity of punishment. O Allah, make me firm in thy religion as long as thou keepst me alive. And make not my heart to swerve after thou hast guided me, and give me mercy from thee. Surely thou art the giver. Bless Muhammad and the household of Muhammad, and make me one of his followers and his partisans, and muster me in his band, and give me the success of accomplishing the obligatory observance of Friday, and performing the acts of obedience which thou hast made incumbent upon me within it, and receiving the bestowal which thou hast apportioned for its people on the day of recompense. Thou, only thou, art the mighty ones.
Spotlight.
Hello, welcome to the Spotlight. I'm Kaveh Takwe. The U.S. debacle in Afghanistan continues to bring severe criticism against Western countries who were NATO members, especially the U.S. Was the U.S. the country that stayed in Afghanistan the most to blame for the way that this 20-year war has actually ruined the country? In this edition of the Spotlight, we will look at how the U.S. deceived the world on this war and whether countries that have the U.S. backing are now doubtful of the U.S. support and what it can do for them. Joining us for this edition of the Spotlight, Sayyid Mohsin Abbas is a journalist and political commentator. He joins us from London. Also, Edward Corrigan joins us. He's an international human rights lawyer who joins us from London, Ontario. Okay, I'd like to welcome you both. And Edward Corrigan, let me first start with you. And I'm going to start out with a question that seems to be on the minds and on the lips of everybody in a matter of speaking, whether it's on social media or even in the news itself. And it's a basic question. Is the Taliban investment that happened and now the fact that they're in control of Afghanistan the fault of the U.S.?
In many respects, yes. First of all, the Americans helped arm and train the Islamic militants in Afghanistan to fight the Soviets, and that transformed into the Taliban. So the Americans, especially the CIA and MI6, the British Intelligence Agency, played a major role in installing the Taliban in power. And it wasn't until the Taliban were approached and demanded money to build a pipeline from the Caspian sort of gas fields through Afghanistan to Pakistan out, that there became an issue for the American multinational oil corporation, said that if you don't accept our offer, then we'll look at regime change. And then, of course, September 11th happened, and the United States seized upon that as a pretext to attack Afghanistan and also to invade and attack Iraq, both of which are important in terms of their energy supplies, and we're also independent governments. But if you're going to, you know, attack the Arab nationalists like Saddam Hussein, who are the mortal enemies of the Islamic forces like the Taliban or Al-Qaeda and Osama bin Laden, you know, you can't destroy the Arab nationalists plus, you know, attack the Islamic movement. But either way, the Taliban was a indigenous political movement strongly based upon the Pashtuns, which are the largest ethnic group in Afghanistan. And they're, you know, fiercely independent. They want to run their own country. And of course, they weren't going to accept the lies of the United States. The United States demanded Osama bin Laden be turned over to them. And the Taliban said, well, okay, we'll provide us proof that Osama bin Laden was involved with the attacks on 9/11. The Americans never provided the proof, but their response was to start bombing Afghanistan and then to invade it. And, you know, bin Laden was in fact a hero in Afghanistan to the Afghan people because of the role he played in freeing Afghanistan from the occupation from the Soviet Union.
Okay.
And the Americans, you know, were lying to their own people, but they can't get away with those lies with the people in Afghanistan.
Well, let's go back here, say Mohsen Abbas, and I'm going to ask you for some examples in short, but one of them that's very startling that many have forgotten, but it was based on an expose that came out a few years back. That said, CIA-backed death squads in Afghanistan killed children as young as 8 in a series of night raids that were being executed, many targeting the madrasas, which is the religious schools. And in one example, back in 2018, one of the death squads attacked one in Wardak province, in which there was a child as young as 8 years old that was targeted in that attack. Just one example of some of the atrocities that happened in that country. So it's not as if the U.S. does not have a tarnished history there. You can expand on that for us or name other examples.
Yes, I mean, I think how many examples does one need to give? First of all, the perspective that you have to have is that 250,000 people have been killed in this war. Of those, only 1% happen to be American soldiers, something like 2,500 approximately. Around 3,500 contractors, U.S. contractors, have died. So you can see that the killing has been overwhelmingly not only the ordinary Afghan civilians, of which, you know, what's accepted is about 70,000 or so have been killed. It's probably a lot larger because these figures are all very, very, you know, they're very vague. Now, Afghan troops themselves, another 50,000 to 70,000 dead there. You see, we're talking tens of thousands, hundreds of thousands, and the operations that were carried out were clearly, you know, inaccurate. Drones going in on supposed information, intel that they'd received, and picking whole families. I mean, we know for a fact that the Afghans live in quite large communes. You know, a whole family will live, for instance, within one sort of communal area. So if these drones and missiles were attacking these places, of course there were civilians, children, women, you know, all in the same compounds. These were people were killed indiscriminately on not just one occasion, but, you know, on hundreds and hundreds, if not thousands, of sorties that are actually just indiscriminately murdered, killed and maimed. You've seen an example again of the aircraft that took off. Even with those people who were working for them, the scant regard for life was such that you could see that the American military was loading their dogs up quite efficiently when it came to the Afghans that they, if you like, owed something to, presumably, they were happier for them to fall off or be run over by aircraft or whatever. Everybody's seen those horrendous scenes. This is the kind of, if you like, attitude that they've had to life in Afghanistan. It's been atrocious. So I won't go into the money figures. I mean, $2.3 trillion, just for the record, is what it's cost them. The return has been, you know, abysmal in terms of every kind of measure that you want to put forward. And the American public itself will be footing the bill for all the loans that they've taken out in order to sustain this war.
Indeed.
I tell you who has profited, though. All those corporate outfits that have been supplying opium and poppies and drugs around the world, 84% of the drugs in the world comes from Afghanistan, overseen during this 20 years of the U.S. debacle. So, to be honest with you, military contractors, they profited a lot. You know, a lot of the corporations like Lockheed and Boeing and all the money men, they've made a lot of money out of this war. But the losers have been primarily the poor Afghan civilians and people, and that is really very much on the doorstep of the American military and its leaders.
Indeed. I'm going to actually come back to you, Sayyid Mohsin Abbas, about some of those monetary aspects of this, which is actually a flashback. But before that, let me come to you, Edward Corrigan. You know, the last week, if you were to look at Afghanistan and imagined that the Taliban would be holding a press conference that would be broadcast across the world to explain what it's going to be doing and that it had a hold on the country, nobody would believe you. But at this point, that's what happened, and we just witnessed that press conference yesterday. Reassuring in some senses of many different things, such as the role that women are going to play, including a functional government, etc., in so many words. Do you take the Taliban's word for the way that they want to integrate themselves on the international stage, given the impression that they're giving at this point?
Well, I would be very cautious. The Taliban in the last 20 years have matured as a political organization, and they certainly have established themselves that they are a power to be reckoned with in Afghanistan. And with the ease, they took over the country. You know, many of the cities fell without even a single shot being fired. There was, you know, so that they're, you know, but it's not really a surprise. You know, generals and commanders of the Afghan operation have said for years that we're losing this war. You know, if you're torturing people, you're killing civilians, you're doing what's called double tap, you bomb a compound, and when people come to, you know, help, you bomb it again to kill the people who are trying to, you know, provide medical assistance. You know, there's, you know, massive bombing, the death squads, torture at various prisons. All of these things are designed either to crush the opposition, but what they do is, in fact, they fan the flames of the opposition and hatred of the Americans because of what the Americans and their allies were doing. So in many respects, the informed commentators were not surprised. I was not surprised. I wrote articles years ago saying, what are we doing in Afghanistan? This makes no sense. And when you invade a country, destroy it, kill people, you know, you're not going to have people praising you and loving you for this, okay? It creates a big backlash. And the Taliban, which are based largely in the Pashtun population, which is the largest ethnic group in Afghanistan, they wrap themselves in, you know, sort of the flag of Afghanistan and being independent, standing up for their own culture, their own rights, their own political independence. And, you know, the Afghans are fiercely independent. Alexander the Great couldn't conquer them. Genghis Khan couldn't conquer them. The British Empire couldn't conquer them. The Soviet Union couldn't conquer them. And now the American Empire and its NATO allies couldn't conquer Afghanistan either. So, you know, it's called the graveyard of empires. And that's is very true. But when you are behaving in such a way and killing people indiscriminately, using torture and death squads and other things to try to crush a population, you know, the history proves that this policy actually doesn't work. And it creates a big backlash. And people hate you for what you're doing.
Well, let's go back now to you, Mohsin Abbas. Let's go back. It's a flashback, and I'd like to test your memory to the year 2011 Mohsen Abbas, when Julian Assange, through the WikiLeaks revelation, said, and I'm going to quote him, "The goal in Afghanistan is to use the country to wash money out of the tax bases of the U.S. and Europe through Afghanistan and back into the hands of a transnational security elite. The goal is an endless war, not a successful war." Again, back in 2011. Do you think that was the case?
I think Assange hit the nail on the head on many issues. America never went into Afghanistan because of the hunt for bin Laden or a war on terror. That was never the purpose. The purpose was always, quite logically from their point of view, given that they are an imperialist power that wants to dominate and does operate on the basis of plunder, in fact makes its money on the plunder from especially the Western Asia sort of Islamic world for many, many decades. That's just an obvious thing to state. But part of that would be, part of that plunder was to look at the $2 or $3 trillion worth or more of Afghan minerals and other resources that are locked within Afghanistan. It is not a poor nation in the sense that it has these kind of hugely important resources. For instance, lithium. Lithium is going to be the future in the sense of electric cars and Tesla and whatnot. If you think about how important such a substance will be, well, Afghanistan has it in the most abundant quantity you can imagine. That would not have gone unnoticed by the transnational corporations, who usually are the ones who drive many of these industrial military projects which America fronts. So yes, they would have wanted their hands on all sorts of resources. Not only that, they knew about the Chinese Belt and Road Initiative, which was looking at Afghanistan as a major link within all that. So the Americans were desperate to try and prevent that happening. They, with their partnership with India, were also looking to allow India to become the major player in Afghanistan and the backer on the regional level. And that was something, quite frankly, that Pakistan was never going to allow. And at the same time, the Americans had this double policy where they were using the Pakistanis to, if you like, attack what they said were terrorists or part of their anti-terrorism war. Well, Pakistan, I would say, played America rather well. What they did was, on the one hand, they pretended to be fighting the war on terror, and at the same time, they were really training and preparing the Taliban, the neo-Taliban, I call it, and they prepared them on such a level that they were able to fight the kind of war which was fought against America in Vietnam. They used the same tactics, essentially, and cutting off the supply lines, cutting off the routes that NATO had to Pakistan. These things put America on the back foot, and Pakistan giving safe haven, essentially, off the record, to Taliban forces, replenishing them, etc., would also have really basically bled America. That's what ensured. Partly, they didn't get what they wanted in that land.
All right. Well, Edward Corrigan, we've had some statements come from a number of countries on this issue. I'd like to get your reaction to what Iran's President Ibrahim Raisi has said, which overall he said that Iran is ready to cooperate with China and with Russia to establish peace and security in the country. And I'm going to quote him: "Iran backs efforts to restore stability in Afghanistan, and as a neighboring and brotherly nation, Iran invites all groups in the country to reach a national agreement." Give us your take on what he has said, especially in the fact that this sounds like something that China and Russia obviously entertain, the approach that Iran has on this.
Well, Iran has a large border with Afghanistan, and they know that there's problems in Afghanistan that's going to affect Iran. And as it is, there's waves of refugees fleeing Afghanistan into Iran. And Iran has a lot of ties. There's a lot of Shia in Afghanistan, and people who speak actually the second language or first language in Afghanistan is Dari, which is a variation of Farsi. So there's a lot of connections, and Iran, it's in its interest, and it's only logical to sort of support peace and to try to maintain the country and to prevent any fallout that we've seen, like with the refugees fleeing from from Africa, North Africa, into Europe. It creates chaos. For Iran actually has taken a very large degree of the refugee flows from Afghanistan, as has Pakistan. They know that this is local. They know that they need to control the situation, and it should be done by the neighbors and the countries in the area, not by force by the Americans or the British or any of their allies coming in and sort of trampling upon the sovereignty and the rights of the Afghan people. And this is the same problem that Iran has faced, that all the colonial powers have faced, tried to impose their will on their colonies. And this is simply, unacceptable. And in 90% or more of the cases, it doesn't work, like we've seen in China with Vietnam, but even, elsewhere too, unless you're talking about Grenada or Panama. The Americans haven't won a war since the end of the Second World War. And, this is, you can't go in and just, carpet bomb places and murder people and set up, death squads. These are not aberrations. In Vietnam, the Americans set up something called the Phoenix Program that systematically went out and assassinated 60,000 South Vietnamese teachers and leaders. And this was done, and it's the same thing they did in El Salvador. It's actually got the name, the El Salvador Program in Guatemala. Israel's been doing it with regard to death squads, and attacking Iran and assassinating, its scientists. We talk very nicely about, oh, we're civilized, we support human rights, but when you look at what our actual policies are in the West, it's 90% or more, the exact opposite.
Iran has said, Seymour Sin Abbas. Sorry to jump in, but the final question goes to you, Seymour Sin Abbas. Iran has said, Iran's President Ebrahim Raisi, that the defeat of the United States has opened an opportunity to revive life, security, and lasting peace for that country. Is that what we're going to see? And in cooperation with Russia and China, perhaps, to come to the aid of Afghanistan in that respect?
Well, certainly any neutral would want peace, security, and safety for the Afghans. That's the least they deserve after what they've been put through by NATO and the US forces over these decades. So, I think it's very encouraging that China, Iran, Russia, and Pakistan, and also Turkey, have been making really good noises about supporting this emerging governance. This is not the same Taliban we saw in 2001. These chaps have been giving amnesties to the workers. They've been allowing the government, previous government officials, to continue. They've declared an amnesty for all previous people. They've not been committing violence. They've been looking after also the minorities. So, for instance, the Shia minorities have also been very much on board. And this is partly because the Islamic Republic of Iran has engaged in some very good diplomacy with the Taliban over the years. And there is a very fraternal relationship that seems to be in place. Now, the danger is, of course, and this is the real final point, that the Americans and the West hasn't changed its attitude. Already the Americans have frozen $7 billion of Afghan funds, according to the central bank's governor, in reserves. The Federal Reserve has $7 billion out of the $9 billion that is outside of the country. They're not releasing that. So you can see straight away they're blackmailing the Taliban, because without that sort of money, of course, governance is a lot harder. The Taliban has its own resources that are coming in. But this is now the question. Will NATO and the Americans allow the Taliban to establish, as they're saying, an Islamic government, which is based on justice and the rule of law? It remains to be seen, because they have their al-Qaeda's, they have their links with the TTP and others. They can cause terror in Afghanistan. So that's what needs to be watched.
Indeed. It's a wait-and-see game, obviously. Thank you very much for that. Seymour Sin Abbas, journalist and political commentator from London. And thank you, Edward Corrigan, international human rights lawyer from London, Ontario. And with that, we come to an end for this edition of The Spotlight. From me, Kavita, my entire team, it's goodbye. Until next time.
Iranian Radio, Global Mission. This is IRIB English Radio.
in the limelight. Three U.S. Central Intelligence Agency officers have reported serious symptoms of the Havana syndrome since December of last year, following spying assignments abroad, requiring treatment at the Walter Reed Medical Hospital in the United States capital, Washington. One case was reported within the past week. We now present you an article written by staff writers of the New York Times. The piece is titled, Mysterious Brain Injuries Hitting U.S. Diplomats, Military Officials, Spies Creates Panic. A shocking and potentially dangerous ailment known as the Havana syndrome, mostly affecting U.S. diplomats, spies, and defense officials, has been reported in the United States in recent weeks. At least 130 incidents of mysterious brain injuries, some of them in past few weeks, have sent shockwaves across the country at a time when it is emerging from the COVID-19 pandemic. The U.S. Central Intelligence Agency, the CIA, CIA officers have reported serious symptoms of the Havana syndrome since December of last year, following spying assignments abroad, requiring treatment at the Walter Reed Medical Hospital in the U.S. capital, Washington. One case was reported in the past week alone. According to the New York Times report citing four current and former officials, in one case from 2019, not previously reported, a military officer serving overseas pulled his vehicle into an intersection, then was overcome by nausea and headaches. His son, sitting in the car, was shock-stricken. Both received medical attention, though it is not clear whether they suffered long-term debilitating effects. The report said the episode distressed officials in both the Trump and Biden administrations, prompting them to launch a probe. The report further states the number of cases within the CIA, the State Department, the U.S. Defense Department, the Pentagon, and elsewhere have sparked concern in the Biden administration, adding that the initial publicity confirmed cases have been concentrated in China and in Cuba, and numbering to about 60. According to the National Security Council, some have suffered long-term brain injuries, including debilitating headaches, while general symptoms involve personnel experiencing sensory phenomena, such as sound, pressure, or heat, along with or followed by physical symptoms, such as sudden onset of vertigo, nausea, and headache or neck pain. The U.S. administration has not been able to determine who or what is responsible for the shocking episodes. However, the New York Times report claims some Pentagon officials believe Russia's military intelligence agency is involved in it. Moscow has repeatedly denied any such involvement. Amanda Shoup, a spokeswoman for the Office of the Director of National Intelligence, is quoted as saying by the New York Times, "As of now, we have no definitive information about the cause of these incidents, and it is premature and irresponsible to speculate." The report states the Biden administration is trying to show officials that they are taking the issue seriously, and at the same time trying to prevent panic from spreading, either inside the government or amongst the public. According to the U.S. National Security Council spokesperson, Emily Horn, the Council has begun an intelligence review. The report notes the CIA has formed a new targeting cell to try to gather information about the episodes, how they occurred, and who is responsible, adding that the cells aim to operate with a similar rigor and intensity after the group expanded by the agency sometime after the 11th of September attacks to hunt down Osama bin Laden. In a report released in December, the U.S. National Academy of Sciences said a microwave weapon probably caused the brain injuries. The severity of the mysterious brain injuries on the U.S. military officials and spies has ranged widely, with some victims complaining of chronic, potentially irreversible symptoms and pain, suggesting potentially permanent brain injury. Physicians at the Walter Reed Medical Hospital have even warned government officials that some victims would be tempted to end their lives. According to a report in a closed-door meeting of the Senate Intelligence Committee last month, senators accused the CIA, the Central Intelligence Agency, of doing too little to investigate the mysterious episodes. It said during the Trump administration, some in the agency said there was little intelligence showing a foreign power was responsible, and argued that it made little sense analytically for Russia or another foreign intelligence service to make unprovoked attacks on Americans. Others doubted the cause of the brain injuries. The New York Times report states that the mystery first drew attention when diplomats and CIA officers working in Havana, Cuba in 2016 felt sick with vertigo, nausea, and headaches. Similar episodes began occurring the next year in Guangzhou in China. And last October, the New York Times reported that as early as 2017, another cohort of CIA officers traveling in a variety of countries, including in Russia, had said they were the likely victims of attacks and reported similar symptoms. Lawmakers and the Trump administration's National Security Council grew increasingly frustrated last year with State Department's and the CIA's handling of the incidents. Robert C. O'Brien, President Trump's National Security Advisor, and Matthew Pottinger, his deputy, had begun working in early 2020 to redouble efforts by their aides to understand the mysterious episodes and to get the Pentagon more involved. But their staff members ran into frustration getting the CIA, the State Department, and other agencies to share details about injured personnel, in part because of federal protections on health data. The report adds White House officials thought the investigation, in which the CIA had been the lead agency, had run into a dead end.
Our voice comes from the heart of beautiful Iran. IRIB English Radio. This is IRIB English Radio. Coming up is the news.